everybody, and welcome to Thin Air, news with an altitude from small town public radio in the Rockies and Four Corners. I'm John Kovash.
I'm Gina Garacio. Howdy. This month, will the Amtrak revival ever make it out west?
Trains are on the way back. The Amtrak is a good example.
On the San Miguel River, we visit the Ark, a place where wild animals get a second chance.
That's Wiley the coyote.
Also, Crested Butte looks at its housing dilemma. And from Alamosa, highway checkpoints. Are they constitutional?
You could be driving down the highway during a checkpoint and they could see your windshield was cracked.
While it still burns, the Los Alamos fire has already had a sweeping effect in 11 western states. A federal moratorium on prescribed burns, and the biggest debate on fire management since the Yellowstone fire.
Colorado Governor Bill Owens, not a man to espouse red tape, has enacted a new permit process. Federal land managers must now submit their burn plans to the state health department. Owens cited the fires around Durango in 1998 as an example of the failure of federal burn policies. Elsewhere, the LA Times editorialized that the real message of Los Alamos is that not enough western forest has been intentionally burned. But in New Mexico, those in the path of the fire are already pushing for a new approach. Lands in high-risk areas like Flagstaff would have to be fire-proofed by tree thinning before any more intentional burns are allowed.
As the fires were still burning, scientists at the University of New Mexico were saying the last thing needed is more rain. A containment and cleanup plan has already begun with big federal funding. Meanwhile, some Santa Fe residents say the EPA has been slow to monitor and analyze air quality effects from the fire. Fire burned within feet of Technical Area 18, one of the most secret nuclear sites, and Area 55, the plutonium facility. The fire also raced through the high explosive area and a still unknown number of the 1,500 nuclear and hazardous material dump sites at the Los Alamos lab.
In Crested Butte, the proposed Vergy Ranch annexation has raised the familiar issues of housing versus growth impacts. Tony Todd reports from KBUT.
Last year's council had approved a sketch plan for the project presented by developers Lacey and Dow. Veteran Councilman Ted Bosler expressed his view on the benefits of the project.
The 14 acres of affordable housing or potential development land is incredible. If we don't do that, we're going to shut the door on this town.
Some members of the council have expressed reservations toward the annexation in recent months. Led by newly elected Mayor Linda Powers, they assessed the developer with an impact fee of some $820,000.
We as a town become responsible for providing services. That means that the snow plows that we now have to plow that many more streets. The school has to take care of that many more.
Some citizens in attendance, like Mark Heller and Harvey Castro, said that charging the developer makes sound financial sense.
It's actually a responsible analysis and strategy to keep the town solvent for the next 20 years.
Irregardless of the value of the land that we may be getting and the other things that you might want to place a value on, there's still going to be a shortfall. How much of that shortfall are you guys all willing to pay for?
Others, like Jamie Kurtz and Vic Shepard, believe this project is essential.
It's done by a local who has a very, very good track record. If this doesn't work, eventually that is going to be make up of 35-acre parcels. There will be no town parks. There will be no trails. There will be no bike path. There will be no river access.
In Aspen, doctors and principals live in the affordable housing, and so we may be closer to becoming an Aspen than we would like to admit.
Ultimately, developer Daniel Dow presented council with an ultimatum. Take it, he said, or leave it.
So we're going to withdraw our proposal.
You have a choice. You can vote on it, and it can go, or we will withdraw.
This analysis is so one-dimensional, it's laughable.
A bit shaken by the demand, Powers offered to rescind the impact fees, provided Lacey and Dow would give parties involved more time to confer over various elements of the proposal.
And when this project came along, I wasn't real satisfied, and I have great fears for the future of this town fiscally if we don't get our fees.
David Leinsdorf, the developer's attorney.
Indeed, the very fabric of Crested Butte as a community will be determined by whether or not we can provide affordable housing at this end of the valley. It has not happened in Aspen, where the billionaires are driving out the millionaires. It has not happened in Telluride, where Big Eastern and California money is supreme. And it will not happen in Crested Butte unless you do everything within your power to provide affordable housing.
Lacey and Dow offer to pay an additional $320,000 for expansion of the water treatment plant. They also promise to put in street signs, build a cattle guard, and pave 9th and Red Lady Avenues. For KBUT, I'm Tony Todd. In many parts of the country and throughout Colorado, police checkpoints have become commonplace, but state courts have been divided on their constitutionality. Lawyers, citizens, and even police officers are voicing concern. David Summerstein looks at these factors in light of a recent safety checkpoint in Alamosa.
You're driving down the highway on a Sunday morning. Ahead of you are several parked police and civilian cars. An officer stands just to the side of the road and waves for you to pull over for a routine safety check. That's what happened recently to Monica Henderson.
We was on our way out of town and we've got flagged over by the cops to do an inspection.
She was surprised to see what she thought was a sobriety checkpoint so early in the day.
Made me feel like they were trying to catch drunk drivers.
Safety checkpoints are becoming increasingly common in the United States. Police pull over motorists at random or according to a criteria, say every fourth car, and ask for driver's license, registration, and valid insurance. Few would argue that vehicle safety is in the public interest, but stopping for a routine safety check also gives police a chance to get a good look inside your car. The AAA, the nation's largest organization for motorists, agrees that safety is important, but with a caveat. AAA spokesperson Jeff Sundstrom.
We do not necessarily support law enforcement actions that unduly inhibit people's freedom to move freely from place to place.
The Fourth Amendment protects individuals against unreasonable searches and seizures and requires law enforcement officials to have probable cause to look into your car. Mark Silverstein, legal director for ACLU Colorado, believes that any intrusion into a person's freedom should be based only on an individualized suspicion of wrongdoing. Pulling groups of motorists over at random falls outside the realm of this probable cause.
Unfortunately, the ACLU point of view has not always been winning in the Supreme Court. The watering down of the requirement of probable cause is one of the areas in which the Supreme Court has been willing to expand the powers of law enforcement at the expense, we believe, of civil liberties.
Through a series of cases, the U.S. Supreme Court has weighed the protection of individual Fourth Amendment rights against the public interest to curtail certain behaviors. The public interest to find bombs in airports, for example, outweighs personal freedoms, so all airline passengers must submit to a search by a metal detector. This is the same reasoning used to legalize sobriety checkpoints. But does the public interest for safe vehicles outweigh individual rights? Captain Jeffrey Babcock of the Colorado State Patrol oversaw the recent safety checkpoint.
The state law and the Patrol Act gives the Colorado State Patrol and its officers authority to pull people over to check the documents and the equipment that's required by law to be on the vehicles. So the answer to that question is, yes, people do have to be pulled over or pull over when they're requested to do so, and they do have to submit to those checks.
Deputy Public Defender for Alamosa, Manuel Lopez, interprets the Colorado statute differently. He notes that the law hinges on the phrase, upon reasonable cause.
You could be driving down the highway during a checkpoint and they could see your windshield was cracked, or that, you know, there was some other visible physical defect of the car. Barring that, I don't think they have a right to stop you.
The results of the Alamosa safety checkpoint show that over 70% of the motorists pulled over that day had nothing wrong with their cars. That high a percentage begs the question of whether safety checkpoints are the best way to serve the public interest of safe roads. Colorado is one of few states that doesn't have mandated vehicle safety inspections. When Monica Henderson and her husband James got pulled over, they questioned why the police were using checkpoints when regular safety inspections would be more thorough and effective.
It didn't seem like they checked enough. I mean, well, I'm just saying they just ran a brief, fast whoomph, and it was over and done with.
I have to agree with them. They didn't check, like, exhaust. I think they should just do state inspections instead of that.
I think the police safety checks that are increasing so much throughout America are really a step in the wrong direction.
Joe McNamara is a retired chief of police of San Jose, California, and a research fellow for the Hoover Institution, a conservative think tank at Stanford University. He says checkpoints are a characteristic of totalitarian governments and lend an image of the police as enemies of the people they were meant to serve.
The credibility of the police is what makes the whole system work. The public that trusts the police will report crime, will serve as witnesses, will believe police testimony when they're on the jury, and will also be strongly against crime in their own particular neighborhoods and cooperate with the police. And this is not worth losing to get a few more traffic tickets or to make some more low-level drug arrests that don't really have any significant impact on lessening drug use in this country.
Recently, two courts in Indiana were divided on the legality of checkpoints used to search for narcotics in Indianapolis. The Supreme Court has agreed to hear the case next session as it continues to shape Fourth Amendment rights. I'm David Summerstein in Alamosa, Colorado.
Train revival has yet to come to the American West, but the debate continues. This fall, Colorado voters may decide on a Sierra Club proposal. The Transportation Finance Act would take a bite out of Colorado taxes to make hundreds of millions of dollars available for transit, bicycle, and pedestrian needs. John Kovash reports from on board the California Zephyr.
I had to drive for 2.5 hours to board the California Zephyr in Grand Junction, Colorado, for a round trip to San Francisco. This train has been sold out for 2 weeks. The incoming passengers have just spent the day following the Colorado River, almost from its source to Glenwood Canyon. We'll now head into the Utah Desert Sunset.
Grand Junction. Junction 2.
The Zephyr takes 26 hours to get from Colorado to the San Francisco Bay. In the middle of the night, we'll roll up and down the Wasatch Range and through sleeping Salt Lake City. Those of us in coach will sleep fitfully as we follow Interstate 80. In the morning, we'll awake climbing into the Sierras along the Truckee River.
The Central Pacific Railroad suffered the indignity of its first train robbery.
Earl Jacobson is a volunteer at the Train Museum in Sacramento. For 4 years, he's been doing the play-by-play on Zephyr.
Well, I grew up in a little town back in the Midwest with a little branch railroad, and so about the only excitement in town was to go down and watch the daily train come in. In which I did. The building of the Transcontinental Railroad, of course, was a tremendous engineering feat for its time. See, we'll be going over Donner Summit. We'll be seeing Donner Lake.
Life on the Zephyr is still ungentrified. No four-star restaurants, no fern bars, no windows in the tiny bathrooms. There's your own coach car where you scope out the passengers, college students, grandfathers, single moms, extended families, mysterious loners, lots of kids. You like it when it's bumpy?
Yeah.
You like it when it's fast?
Yeah.
The highways are getting congested. Secondly, there are people that don't like to fly. And this is a great alternative.
I'm going to Sandy, Oregon.
Going to Reno, stay overnight, come back.
No, I'm going to Salt Lake.
So you're moving? You're actually moving?
For right now, I've brought as much in my bags as I possibly can.
All you got to do is look at the extra leg space in the coaches.
It's fast, faster than the bus.
You get on a train and people walk up and down and they say, hi, where are you going? Where are you from? And
I could have drove, but I figured why hassle with it? I'd let the engineer up there do the driving.
Everyone's walking around. You actually get to move around the train. Get to talk to a ton of different people
from all walks of life, all different races.
The observatory car is the social hub of the train. Swivel chairs, panoramic windows, skylights. At night they show bad movies on 3 TV monitors. This car is where you usually find the trainaholics like Fletch Fletcher and Lee Wickert.
And I like trains. I'm riding in one now. Compared to airplanes, it's much friendlier. You ride on Amtrak, you're hoping you're going to be on time. Sometimes you're late.
Well, I mean, what's your earliest memory of being fascinated by trains?
My earliest memory of a train was getting on with my dad at a little town called Morgan Hill, south of San Jose, and riding into town. With the highways, the way they are, more and more people, I think trains are on the way back. The Amtrak is a good example of that. They started out with old antiquated equipment, you know, hand-me-down equipment, and they have, over the years, built it to what you see now.
Overall, the outlook for passenger rail service in America is so bright you got to wear shades. The new Acela Regional, formerly the Northeast Metro Liner, has increased ridership beyond expectations. In February, Amtrak announced an ambitious expansion, which includes a luxury train that will do New York to Los Angeles in 60 hours. Across the continent, Amtrak is rolling more seats to more places. For the first time in 29 years, the Lake County Limited is arriving in Janesville, Wisconsin. New trains are coming to Vicksburg, Shreveport, Abilene, Daytona Beach, and Cape Canaveral. Some will have venerable old names, the Crescent, the Twilight Limited, the Texas Eagle. Amtrak has reactivated 50 locomotives and 26 passenger cars and will be ordering more cars this summer. In the fall, a new train will run between Las Vegas and Los Angeles, early next year from Boston to Portland, Maine. Amtrak is reversing its long-standing policy of cutting service to reduce costs. America's quasi-public rail passenger carrier has resolved to aggressively expand nationwide. What's your hope for the future of rail travel in America?
We've got to expand it and get more high-speed rail in the larger metropolitan areas. The big talk, of course, is to here in California is to hopefully be able to have high-speed rail between Los Angeles and the Bay Area.
In the short term, Amtrak hopes to help pay for expansion by getting into the express mail and shipping business. In the long term, it is Congress that will decide how aggressive the Amtrak expansion will be. Senate Bill 1900 would allow Amtrak to borrow $10 billion to develop high-speed passenger rail corridors, but little money is destined for the kind of trains needed out west. Trains like the California Zephyr and its sister, the Southwest Chief, that can stop in places, little faraway places, like Sparks, Nevada.
Get off the train now, stretch your legs a little bit. There's a couple of vending machines here, papers. Coke, a couple of phones.
With increasing auto gridlock in western cities, the debate is growing over a regional lack of mass transit. Colorado and New Mexico are among only 5 states that still have no dedicated transit funds, but for years, residents of these states have lobbied for new passenger rail routes. In Colorado, a Boulder task force wants a train instead of more lanes on the Boulder Turnpike. The Roaring Fork Valley still hopes to see a train from Glenwood Springs to Aspen. There's talk of new rail to Colorado Springs and to Vail along the I-70 corridor. In New Mexico, commuters want a train between Albuquerque and Santa Fe and restored service between Denver and El Paso. In Utah, many are regretting the loss of a once great passenger hub at Salt Lake City. A night and day after leaving Colorado, the Zephyr turns to cross the Sacramento River and thence follows the very edge of the bay almost to Oakland. There is sparkling new development around the Emeryville station, just like around Denver's Union Station. In between the two are some of the biggest, emptiest spaces on the planet, where if you don't have a car, you can't get there from here. 100 years ago, you could take a narrow gauge. 50 years ago, you could, in many western towns, hop on a Frontier Airlines flight. In the year 2000, as pump prices climb ever steeper, there remains a tantalizing and economically viable choice, the old-fashioned, low-speed, long-haul, unvarnished passenger train.
It's kind of like a party.
It's way better than the Greyhound.
Thank you very much for listening.
You are listening to Thin Air. Arguably, the animals at the Rocky Mountain Arc have one of the greatest views around.
Couldn't be a more beautiful spot.
Nestled on the mesa below Wilson Peak, the 14-acre ranch is home to 60 to 100 different and unique animals. Most of these animals were sentenced to captivity by some kind of human interference.
About 85% of the animals that come to us come here because of some sort of human interference.
That's Lissa Margetz. Since 1977, Lissa's life has been driven by a desire to rescue and rehabilitate animals who can't quite make it on their own. Unfortunately, many of the animals living with her are permanent residents. Now, you're invited on a bittersweet tour of the Rocky Mountain Arc.
He's not going to say anything for us right now. This is Poe, and Poe is a raven. And some kid had kidnapped him out of the nest when he was just a baby, and he wanted a pet raven. And he cut off, when the bird started flying, he cut off all his wing feathers and his tail feathers so he couldn't fly. And he had been raised in a box in the house, and he has absolutely no idea he was a bird. And so for a month and a half, my husband and I were going around with ladders, putting him up against trees and taking this bird up and putting him in the trees at night, because he never learned how to roost. He still doesn't know how to roost. He also never learned how to forage, and so he would never survive out in the wild. This little fellow either fell out of the nest or was kicked out of the nest and has a hard time seeing. He's on a steroid right now, and he can see large objects in bright light, which doesn't help a nocturnal owl who catches mice. So he could be released back out in the wild, we make sure that his vision is adequate for his survival. Otherwise, he may have to be euthanized. And he's just a little fluff ball of down right now. This is Monster. And Monster is a bobcat. Monster was confiscated out of a lady's trailer in Redvale. She knew it was illegal to have him. She had been hiding him in her bathroom in her trailer for over a year. He could hardly use his back legs. He's doing very well now, and you can see he's very affectionate. He's fully armed with tooth and claw. And is he eating your headset? You have to help me out here. We're singing like a coyote. That's Wiley the coyote. And he lives in here with Ruby and Shayla. These are the lions. This one is Ruby. She's an old lady. They usually live from 7 to 11 years in the wild. And she is 14 now. And behind you is Shayla. She was abandoned here when she was 4 months old. This is beyond just doing the physical medical workup on them.
And this is a passion I've had all my life. And I sit down with these animals and I watch them and watch the way that they move and interact with each other and their environment. And I've learned an awful lot from them about life in general. And they have inspired me in so many ways and filled my heart in so many ways that I could never express in words. And it sure make life worthwhile. This is Houdini and his girlfriend, Vermin. They're prairie dogs. Now let's hear his quills. This is Spike, and Spike is our only other non-native species. He was born in a zoo in Dallas, and his brother ate his left ear off, so they call that one Tyson and this one Evander, but we just call him Spike. We get an awful lot of abandoned domestic animals, and right here you see Jackson Brown, who was dropped off during Bluegrass Festival 2 years ago. We came home and were putting the animals away, and all of a sudden we heard this, and looked out, and sure enough, here's this little donkey. This is Sierra, and Sierra is a beautiful, large red-tailed hawk. And she is also an imprint. There's a small window of opportunity when an animal is a baby where it learns what it is and how to act by its parents. And this particular one, like Poe the Raven, was kidnapped out of the nest by a fellow who wanted a wild bird as a pet. She has absolutely no idea how to hunt in the wild. She has always been fed it by hand. In here you have Teton, who is the golden eagle over there. And that's Liberty, the bald eagle.
Could you talk a little bit about the licensing, how you got the licenses for all these different kinds of animals?
Oh my goodness, this was over a 20-year period of time. With each animal that came in, it brought in a new issue or a new license. If it's a bird of prey, it's protected by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, which required a U.S. Fish and Wildlife rehabilitation permit. If the animal was kept permanently, it required a scientific collection permit. If it was an eagle, it was an eagle exhibition permit. If it was an animal like this desert fox or the coyote or the mountain lion, it was a commercial park license. I would never ever use the word pet with any of these guys. They're wild animals. These are not cool, neat, great stories. Ooh, gee, come look at my pet mountain lion. These are sad stories. It would be so much better to see that bald eagle flying over my head or catching a fish in the wild than with a wing injury in a aviary for the rest of her life. She can live for up to 50 years, and she will be with me the rest of her life because of one foolish act by some senseless human being.
For Thin Air, I'm Gina Garacio.
Thanks once again for listening. Thin Air is brought to you by the High Country Community Radio Coalition.
Funding comes from your local station and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Participating stations include KRZA in Alamosa, KAJX in Aspen, KGNU in Boulder, KBUT Crested Butte, KDNK Carbondale, KDUR Durango, KUNM Albuquerque, also KZMU in Moab, KRCL in Salt Lake City, KAFM in Grand Junction, and KVNF in Paonia.